ready.
You ready?
There we go.
Where's my sheet here? There we go. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to bring to order the May 21st, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Welcome to everyone. Thank you all very much for being here. I think we're going to have a very interesting presentation today. And I think largely because of Roger Byer's foresight into this problem, we're going to hear about a problem that may be literally underfoot, and we're not aware of this.
But we'll slug
our way through it.
But we will, according to Vice Chair Krieger, slug our way through it.
He couldn't stand it. He just had to do it.
I was going to say, it sounded like we might be involved in a slugfest.
But even though it's even though the puns are just enough to drive you crazy up here, nonetheless, let it be known that last time we had an appreciation for wine, and today it's escargot. So
there you go.
So with that, I'm going to call forward, please, Roger Byer to help set the stage on a problem that. This actually may be somewhat of a groundbreaking hearing here, and perhaps a call to action.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Byer. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Seed Council. I also represent the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and the Oregon Blueberry Commission, all of which are somewhat affected by this issue, but probably not to the degree of the seed industry in the state of Oregon. So I'd like to thank first you, Mr. Chair, for agreeing to hold this fascinating and interesting hearing. And I know that the hearing room behind me is so full, and there's over four rooms that, that people can't even squish into anymore. Because when you see something on an agenda that says we're going to talk about slugs, that's just more than most people can handle. But this is an issue that I think as the panels come up behind me, you will it will startle you, the impact that this problem is having on agriculture in the state of Oregon. It startled me as we started developing these numbers after you agreed to hold this hearing. I assembled my team of people who do our research and who try to work to solve this problem, and asked them to get concrete numbers, to try to get estimates of costs, and of both costs of production and costs of control, costs of marketing, and get that for the committee so you will have the information. I'm not going to spoil their surprise by giving you those numbers, but it was staggering to me when I started seeing these numbers compiled. Some might ask, why now? I mean, a slug is a native species in Oregon. Snails are a native species in Oregon. I will tell you there are a couple reasons, at least for the seed industry, why now. And I can speak most directly to the seed industry because that's what I'm involved in directly. I can speak a little bit to the Christmas tree industry because there are people, but there are people behind me that can do that better. But for the seed industry, why now? There are a couple reasons. And first and foremost, this problem has been ramping up in the last 5 years, and there's a direct correlation in time to why that is. 5 years ago, actually 6 years ago, the 2009 session of the legislature banned the burning of grass seed fields in the southern and the Willamette Valley, with a small exception of the Silverton Hills. We have seen over the past 5 years that ban took effect in 2010. Over the last 5 years, this problem has grown exponentially. I believe it is directly correlated. One of the reasons is directly correlated to that event, field burning controlled slugs. Let's face it. You put a slug next to a fire, the slug doesn't win. That's just you know, it's physics, it's biology, it's whatever you want to call it. That's reality of life. So whereas not every field was burned every year, at the time the argument was made, we could control pests by burning, and we didn't have to burn it every year. You could move that fire around the valley in a manner in which you could control your problems with every 2 or 3 years, whatever. It was a way to control the problem. So I'll point to that point in time. There are other factors you will hear from, one of which is another invasive species, or there are many invasive species. These slugs and snails are not native to Oregon. And I think you've heard about invasive species already this session in your other committee meetings and other issues. This is another area where invasive species is affecting the industries. So with those two as primers, I'd like to allow the experts to come forward. I think we've assembled a good team. Hopefully it won't take all your appetite away before the end for lunch coming up. But thank you again, Mr. Chair, for agreeing to hold this hearing. It's important to us in the industries. And as again, I think you'll be staggered by the numbers that we've assembled. With
Roger,
that, I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you so very, very much. And thank you for bringing what you have convinced me. And I think the witnesses that you've helped Mr. Gallagher bring forth today are going to convince us is a very, very significant problem that needs to be addressed.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Macy Wessels, Helmuth Rogg, and Robin Rosetta. I'd like to welcome each of you this morning to our committee. Thank you very much for your willingness to appear, and please decide among yourselves the order of your testimonies.
You want me to go first? Okay. This is my PowerPoint right here. Is there a way to get it up onto the screen so you guys can see?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having us today, and thank you, members of the committee, for listening to us. I'm sure the last thing you guys want to learn more about is slugs, but it's a significant issue.
Yes.
I'm Macy Wessels. I'm a grower out of Scio, Oregon, with my family. We farm about 3,000 acres. I'm the production manager for Barenbrug USA, which is a seed company, and our company brings in about 20 million pounds of seed that I bring in from all over the world that I contract acres for and I'm responsible for. I'm the first vice chair of the Oregon Seed Council, and I'm the chairperson of the Tall Fescue Commission. Okay, so today I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about economic impact that it has on growers. And I warn you that it's a little bit staggering, even for me, when I saw these numbers. As growers, we go out and we fight them, but we don't actually sit down as an industry and talk about what we're really losing, because it's just something we deal with.
Yes.
It has gotten worse exponentially in the last few years, and so what used to be one or two applications to take care of a problem has now gotten to the point that maybe it's four or five, and on top of it, a lot of times we don't even gain control. I know within my own company at Barenbrug, we lost 7% of our production alone just in the Willamette Valley this year, where it was a complete loss. The grower had to just give up and start over. That doesn't include all the number of acres that they had to actually just fight throughout the whole fall and spring planting season. So I think I just click. Okay, so as you guys are probably aware, we had a slug summit in which we asked industry reps, OSU, USDA, and also growers to come and participate. This was really, really interesting because we asked members from all across the agricultural community to come in, and the room was packed to the point that we had to bring in extra seats, which for growers in particular, that never happens from the standpoint they can't give up a day to come and spend a day at a meeting that's talking about something. It just shows how much support and how many people across the board think this is an issue. Within the room, we had members of people that were mitt industry, grass seed, row crops, nursery crops. I mean, it was staggering. And really, until we actually all sat down in a room, we didn't realize that it was particularly, like myself included, didn't even know that it was an issue for Christmas trees per se. So that was really interesting. One of the few things, I mean, there was a lot of comments made, but it was growers at this point are just somewhat frustrated. They feel like they're throwing money out the window because we're not getting control anymore. We're just losing this battle continuously. In the second quote there, it says that a North Valley field had put multiple applications. You're going to see in my numbers that I'm only reflecting maybe two applications, maybe, which is more average, but more and more you're seeing five applications and then complete loss because you don't know when to give up. You know, from a grower standpoint, you want to do everything to save that. So you kind of keep, oh, we're going to beat them. Oh, we're going to beat them. And you just keep throwing money at it. And at some point, you do have to pull the plug. So it's a really difficult decision to make. Okay, so I'm going to show you the big number first, and I will explain to you how we kind of came to it, and then behind this slide will be supporting numbers that I won't go into as much detail. You guys will have copies of this. But so this is the financial impact of establishing a crop. So there's a difference in grass seed industry of establishing a new crop and one that's already there growing. And there is a difference with slugs. Slugs have a huge economic impact on trying to establish the crop. That very first year, the plant's more susceptible, and those slugs really go after it. So you're going to see lost crop there. That's assuming that the crop makes it. Okay, so that $40 million that's up there is assuming that the crop actually makes it. What that is, that calculation you'll see in the next slide, comes from is a reduction in yield. So we took an average reduction in yield of 15%, and we kind of took it towards the high end, and we said, okay, so this is how much it's going to reduce the yield per acre and times what the value of that crop is, and $40 million is what we came up with. And so me as a grass seed grower was staggered by this, because until you actually sit it down on paper, it's, you know, again, you're just fighting it. You don't really think about it. Replanting costs, that's, again, if the crop makes it. You still have to go out and replant certain areas of the field that were taken out by the slugs, because if you don't, you have a weed issue at that point. It's an open area that weeds can grow. And so that's for just replanting the areas that slug damage and the crop made it. And then treatments are what it takes to get that, you know, all the different slug applications that we're making to try to control that, again, with the assumption that the crop is going to make it. Any questions so far?
I have a question, and just $50 million is a staggering figure.
Yeah.
I think you suggested that that is represents 15% of what would be total revenue for a year? Is that accurate or not?
Yeah, okay. So there's, see, the treatments is $7 million.
Yes.
Right there. So that's what goes out on the different applications. And that's with, see, the number of applications. That's 1.5. So I'm assuming that there's 1 to 2 applications, although I'm telling you right now there's a lot of 4 to 5 applications. So we're estimating somewhat low on that. On the next slide right there, so that's the one, that's the big number, the $40
million. Mm-hmm.
So see how there's the average yield right there?
Yes.
Okay, and then the pounds, or the value per pound, and then the damage cost. So that damage cost right there is the percentage of lost stand times what the value of the crop would be. So I don't know the number off the top of my head, but let's say it's 250 pounds per acre is lost. So on an average yield of 1,600 pounds, if it was a normal year and you didn't have slug damage, it would be 1,600 pounds minus 250. So you take the 250, times it by the value of the crop, 70 cents, and that's how you come up with the last damage. So essentially, if you have slug damage and it makes it all the way through, you're going to have, instead of a 1,600 pound yield, you're going to have a 1,250 pound yield, or 300. Don't follow my math. I'm a farmer. This is not my forte.
Thank you. That helps to put things in perspective. It is a very significant loss.
Okay. And then here's the cost of to plant per acre. Like I said, there was those recos plants. So that you see the 2.3. That was the second one on the list, and that's mm-hmm. that's how we came up with that number. And then there. I don't know how to go back.
Roger, did you want to?
Yeah, I think to get to your question, I think your question was, what's the total industry value? Was that your question?
It could be that. It could be yield. It could be a number of things. I'm just trying to get my arms around how big of a loss is this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think the industry value, the most latest numbers for the grass seed industry as a whole for the state of Oregon was just about $400 million crop. That's farm gate value. So we're talking, and again, this $40 million is only half of the number so far. Macy hasn't gotten into this is just establishing the crop. She's not getting into the perennial side of it yet.
My gosh.
So, but we're talking about a total industry value between 375 to 400 million, somewhere around
10%.
or more.
For starters. Yeah. Representative Esquivel.
So that means that the potential of the crop would be in the neighborhood of $450 million if you could not have that 10 or 15% loss.
No, because I'm not done.
Okay. Higher than that.
It gets worse.
It's going to be higher than that. So
That doesn't include your preventative stuff.
No, so that does. That could present, that included the preventative stuff, but that's only for an establishment year. So that's only, so most of the crops, with the exception of annual ryegrass that I'm talking about, are perennial crops. So they're multiple years. So they're going to go for 3 to 4 or 5 years, okay? And so the very first one is $50 million. Just to get it in the ground, get it growing, get that first crop off is $50 million. Now I'm going to talk about the economic damage of an established crop, which is already growing crop that is now going to be affected. Okay, so this is an established crop. So that's $46 million. So that being said, we did the same math, except for the estimated damage is different. It's a different calculation. We still took the percent loss, but we did it at a different rate, of course. And so that's how we came up with the... So the lost crop came up the same way, as we took a percentage of the damage and then times it by what you thought the yield or the average yield and what your loss per acre would be, and that's how you came up with the $46 million. So with the 50 and then the 46 between the two, because we have both crops growing, of course we're looking at maybe closer to $100 million. Well, let's just round down, we'll say 80, just for the sake of argument, to give ourselves some air. Let's say $80 million, and that's a very reasonable number that we're looking at. And again, as a grass seed grower and somebody that contracts seeds with growers, I was astounded by these figures, because we never really sat down as an industry and really looked at this from this angle. So any questions so far?
Everyone good? Okay, thank you.
So again, that's how we got to the numbers, same as before. You guys will have copies of this. Okay, so clover seed, a smaller industry than the grass seed, but still a significant one. We're saying at this point that it's $10 million. And same thing, we did lots of lost crop replanting and treatments. We didn't break it down by establishment year in this case, because clover is susceptible year to year the same way as it would be establishment versus an existing crop. So it's the same.
Representative Gorsuch?
Just to clarify, so mm-hmm. I'm assuming then that baby acres, that's the first year.
Yeah.
And then everything else is after that.
Yep.
So the acres is still an acre, but it's early versus like a repeat crop.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But the $50 million and the $46 million were based on the acres that we have in the ground. Mm-hmm. So we took $50 million on, because we had close to 200,000 acres of baby that got put in this year. So that's the $50 million off that 200,000. And then we have an existing 300,000 of established grass seed that's being grown, and that's how we came up with the $46 million. Okay. So, and again, just background on how we came about to these numbers. I wanted to line it up clearly. That way, if you guys have questions, or, you know, feel free to contact me. So this is some examples of what we're seeing out there. I'm just going to show you some pictures now. So basically, you're seeing, this is baby here, as you can see on the left-hand side. That's what it should look like. Okay, and on the right-hand side, that's what it will look like once slugs moved in. And it's amazing with this process, because it can literally be like you walk out there one day and you see this, and you walk out the next day and you see that.
Wow.
So
literally... Are you saying literally in a day's time, or?
I don't know about 24 hours, but it's that quick. I mean, to a farmer it is. I don't know if we're looking at our crop every single day, but yes, you can walk out there 1 week and have it there and walk out like within a week and see it gone. Wow. So this is a farmer looking at his field, showing the establishment. So he's definitely going to have to re-drill in those areas. If he doesn't, he's going to have a weed issue. This stand right here will make it, but you can see behind him, see how full it is behind him? That's what it should have looked like, and this is what slug damage looks like.
So Have the crops behind him, have they been treated? Is that why?
Everything's been treated. All the fields are treated the same.
So why are we having what appears to be a very significant problem compared to a successful establishment behind him?
Well, hopefully the scientists behind me will be able to understand as growers, so I can give you a specific example. My brother and I both put in baby fescue this year. Mm-hmm. So me as a new grower, it was imperative that I made it. It was my first year with fescue, and there's a huge amount of investment that I put into it. It was my first operating loan. So luckily for me, I was able to control the slugs. I was on top of it, and I did two applications, and my stand made it with minimal slug damage. His field, which was right across the street, which was treated exactly the same, had probably 60% loss. He had to completely replant it.
Wow.
I was glad it was him, not me, but in this particular, he's more established, so he could weather it more. But in general, for new farmers and stuff, this is devastating. Even for old farmers, when you really start looking at the financial impact that we're starting to see on a regular basis and complete stand loss, this is huge. So, same thing. As you can look out across the field, you can see it's spotty. Again, the scientists behind me are probably going to talk more about what slugs like, why they're in particular areas and they're not. In our case, we treat it all the same. So this field was treated completely the same all the way across the board, and yet you're seeing that kind of devastation. Again, as you can see, that should all be green. This is slugs working. It's a hot, sunny day, so you're not going to see them out that time. But in the mornings, or if you went out at night, you would see them working. There you go.
Wow.
That's a perfect example. So this is somebody that flew over their farm. And again, from the outside, it looks like it's doing fairly well. If you get out and you start walking, it's pretty devastating. That right there is at least 40%, 30-40% loss. And again, so they'll either choose to completely start over the next year, but either way, that side of the field will not make a crop. They'll probably replant it so that it's all the same, but part of that field will make a crop and part of it won't.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Yes, Vice Chair McClain, please.
Oh, thank you. Well, when you look at that, I mean, you can see very clearly where they are.
Mm-hmm.
But how long does that effect take? I mean, is it 1 year, 2 years, 3 years before you get the kind of yield that you were talking about in the beginning?
No, so what the farmers will do in this particular case is they'll continue to fight them because they assume that they're there, and they'll do it on the whole field because they don't want it to reinsert. But they'll continue to fight it, and then as the weather gets hotter and drier, even though they know that they lost the stand, they'll replant when slugs aren't there to try to establish again. But they're going to lose that crop year. So, they're going to pick weather conditions in which they can try to establish. Unfortunately, when they're trying to establish and slugs like it the same time plants like it. So when it's rainy and wet and it's a great growing condition for that plant, it's a great condition for slugs. In the case where they're going to have to replant this, it'll be less than ideal because they're going to try to beat the slugs, per se, get it up and growing before it can just kill it. So that being said, I mean, I've talked a lot about grass seed. Obviously, that's where my emphasis lies. But there's also specialty seed crops in this valley. Last I heard, there was 15,000 acres of specialty seed crops. And if you're looking at just like the very minimal, because I don't have numbers put together, $40 per acre at 15,000 acres, you guys can do the math. That's just for treatment. That's not including loss like that. So. And in their case, they're a much higher value crop. So that's another thing to keep in mint. Also, mint establishment is another one that can be affected by slugs. Again, I don't have the numbers, but I'm a mint grower, and I've lost a couple fields to slugs, baby mint. Not establishment, but baby mint. And then wheat was another one that is affected heavily, but we don't have those numbers today either. But we tried to throw this together quickly for you to just try to give you a overall picture of what we're seeing. So, is there any questions?
Anything to this point? Maybe before you proceed, this would be a good time to break just momentarily and recognize the large group of the public who Just walked in a few minutes ago. Vice Chair McLean?
Well, I would really like to. I really appreciate that we have speech and debate students in the room today. And, folks, we're talking about real-world policy here. We're talking about seed industry, and we're talking about the clover industry and other parts of our agricultural economic engine in the state of Oregon. And we have folks here from Tigard High School, and we have our coach, Amber Manning, and we also have Westview High School here, and Sarah Foster is the coach. And then also we have Oak Hill School in Eugene, and the coach is Keith Eddings. So we're just so glad to have you here. And if you guys have questions, we'll make sure you get some of the material afterwards so that you can take that back to your schools. But thank you for being here for our speech and debate day.
And welcome to each of you. Please proceed.
Nope, with that, I think I'm done. As you can see, you know, just in grass seed alone, we're looking at, like I said, close to $80 million worth of loss on a $400 million industry. So it's a significant loss.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's two things that I see when I go home up and down the freeway, which we get to do a lot of that.
Is this? What is this?
Canola.
This yellow? Is that
it's a skate canola field?
It's probably not a canola field because I know the grower. I took this from an article. My guess is it's turnips.
Turnips. Okay. Yeah. What's the white stuff?
Oh, meadowfoam.
Meadowfoam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I see those and I'm wondering what they are.
Yeah. So, and if it's tall like this and it's a white flower, then it would be radish.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the, you were saying the climate for you know, the initial growth and for the slugs is about the same. Does it matter in the fields if one area of the field is more moist than another? You know, if water settles in there, do they gravitate to that?
Well, there'll be people behind me that will probably speak on that, but from a grower perspective, if there's water standing in the field, there's not slugs there, but there's also not grass there.
Yeah.
So...
All right. With that, who's next?
I don't want to be showing slides to you.
Okay.
I don't know if
do you want to switch?
I guess after she's done. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Robin Rosetta. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Horticulture at Oregon State University. I'm also a regional extension educator working with the commercial greenhouse and nursery industry and focused on integrated pest management. As you may know, our nursery industry is extremely large and diverse in Oregon. In the last decade, it often has been the highest value agricultural crop in Oregon. We have the latest data from the National Ag Statistics Service was 745 million, but since that time, I think they've recovered, and that value should be quite a bit higher. At least 1,800 operations, almost closer to 2,000 now. And our top four counties are of production are actually located here in this area. The bulk of the production is in the North Willamette Valley. We have 54,000 acres in production, and it's important to note about 75 to 80% of the product is actually shipped out of state across a state or international border. Oops, I didn't do that right. I'm sorry. Let's see.
Just click.
I'm not sure how to advance.
There
we go. In the last 21 years that I've worked with the nursery industry, I've had a chance to become more aware of the impact of slugs and snails for this industry and to achieve a little bit more knowledge about how to manage the snails and slugs and to get a little bit of a handle on the risks to these growers. In that time, I've developed information for the industry, put together articles, workshops. I also developed an online resource as part of my greater website for information for the growers. And that has been helpful, but we need much more. in addition to that, I was once years ago invited to what was called an exotic gastropod workshop, which is more or less on the exotic and invasive species of snails and slugs. These are the parties I get invited to. But it increased my awareness of the potential risks, not only to the nursery industry, but to the other commodities that we grow here in Oregon. I also co-organized with Cheryl Willen, who is a UC IPM advisor down in San Diego, a working group called the Western Region Slug and Snail IPM Work Group. And we co-organized a meeting held in Portland in 2009 to look at slugs and snails in ornamental systems, a first ever here in the U.S. That was really useful as well because we brought in a diverse group of people, including slug experts, various researchers. We brought in many of the growers in a variety of situations and from all across the West to represent what's happening there. Regulatory representatives and extension folks like myself, as well as folks from the chemical industry. That was really important for us because we wanted to see what the impacts of these slugs were as much as we could, and to develop research priorities, coordinate our research activities, outreach, and see what we could do to move on. And what came out of that was wonderful networking. We know who some of the resources are to connect with, as well as some of the research priorities did get funded. In particular, we identified the egg stage of snails and slugs as a real problematic stage, particularly for nursery shipments, because really it's elusive. It's very hard to see those eggs and monitor for them. And there were no control methods available at all. There's certainly no registered insecticides or molluscicides to treat those things. So there has been work at University of California, Riverside to look at treatment of the egg stage, and that looks promising. So, like the other commodities you'll hear about, the industry does suffer direct damage from slugs and snails. It's an ornamental industry, so the threshold for damage is very low because people notice when entire plants are eaten sometimes. The pressure varies between types of nursery production, the sites, the type of material they grow. Some plants are more lush and more susceptible. Some are not. They're woodier and not attractive to the slugs and snails as much. Now, unlike some of the other commodities, I'm unaware, and I don't think there is any data on losses here in this industry. It would be useful, but we don't have it. And there's limited data on use patterns. We only have the PERS data from quite a long time ago, and very limited sales data that's often proprietary. We did have one industry representative estimate that the nursery industry in Oregon buys about 15,000 pounds of formulated product of metaaldehyde, which is the most commonly used, what we call molluscicide, the type of pesticide we use to kill snails and slugs. And I also want to mention, they also mentioned of the approximately 6 million pounds of metaaldehyde products sold in the U.S., here in Oregon, we buy about 1.4 million pounds of that product. That's about 23% of the national sales in of that one product alone. That gives you some feel for the pressure here. And one of the leading manufacturers of the product said the Northwest and UK are their largest areas for sales. So we don't really have much data on what it's costing the industry in sheer losses or even in the cost of control. I have spoken with some growers to get a little bit of a feel for what they're looking at. One grower, they're sort of a small to mid-sized farm. They have about 100 acres. Their bait bill last year was about $1,200. That's one pest of a diverse range of pests pests that these nurseries have to control. What isn't calculated in that cost is the cost of labor, which is actually significant in this case. It takes about 4 to 8 hours to apply that entire nursery with the bait formulation that they have to put on. And it's not just one application. They're going to have to be out there at least three to four times a year, maybe more, depending on the type of weather that we have during the season they're growing their plants. It doesn't look like it costs a lot, about $2 a pound for some of these materials, but that's not an acre rate. Oftentimes, these labels for nurseries are on a 1,000 square foot type of rate design, and so that's actually covering a very small area. Those costs can be quite a bit higher. And the nursery industry is somewhat unique in that they also have access to methiocarb, which is one of a number of the carbamate insect molluscicides people use. It's a nerve poison, sort of, you know, like many of our older chemistries. It does provide some risk for people. One of the carbamates, the methiocarb, or also known as Measurol, is one of the very few molluscicides that actually works under the same conditions that favor slug activity. The cool, moist type of climate that we have is around most, you know, a lot of the growing season. And these other materials, the metaldehyde, sometimes a little bit the iron phosphate and the chelated iron, they either break down quickly with the moisture and sun, or they become moldy. The baits become moldy in the wet, and the slugs won't feed on them at that time either. So the Measurol is often used when they have an infested situation, a shipment in particular. It's a Category 1 danger label, so they really don't like to use it. It has a long reentry, so they can't get back into that site. It's 24 hours, so it may delay their shipments. And it's $100 an acre in terms of what it costs. And they're not going to spray an entire acre usually, but it is a very expensive material for them to use. Are there any questions to this point on that? Yes. So in addition to the direct damage, what is unique a little bit to nursery is that they also have to be very careful about quarantine. In particular, brown garden snail is one of the most feared quarantines because it is a very rapacious type of snail. It really eats a lot. So there are quarantines in at least 5 other states if we ship to them, which requires the Department of Ag to sign off that there are no snails in there. So that takes an inspection, and again, that can delay a crop. It's a worldwide pest, so a lot of inspectors in a lot of countries and a lot of states are really aware of it. We have had them show up in shipments to, for instance, Canada. That's very problematic for the grower. They'll often refuse that shipment. The grower has to pay for the shipment both there and back to his site. In the meantime, they may lose some plants that are not able to stay in a shipping situation for that amount of time. And every time they intercept a load with something like brown garden snail, the scrutiny on all of the other loads, the difficulty to ship, increases for all of our growers. It's also a threat as well, not only to the nursery industry with the quarantines, but again, if these types of snails get out and get into our other crops, they often have a behavior that they estivate, is what we call it. They get up to the top of the crop and they hang on. That can be a variety, grapes, tree fruit, a lot of wheat crops, that sort of thing, and it contaminates in the harvest, and sometimes people lose entire crops to that. So there are a lot of reasons why people try to keep this out. So, yeah, as I mentioned, if a brown garden snail is found at a nursery, the ODA comes in and they require the nursery to clean up or eliminate all traces of that snail in that area. And I don't believe they can ship anything from that particular area of the nursery. The other problem that nursery has, which is unique, is product contamination, shipment product contamination. In particular, although slugs are a problem, one of the more difficult problems for these guys are actually a little pond snail called an amber snail that gets onto the plant material. And these snails can be, you know, in the thousands in a nursery or on the plant material. As far as the pond snail goes, they don't know it's a nursery. They think it's a pond because they irrigate and there's a lot of water around there. Now, these pond snails in general are predominantly native pond snails to the U.S. The ODA has done a survey and looked at the species, cooperated with people who can do the DNA work, and Helmut can speak further to that. But we're confident we know generally what they are. They don't generally like to eat the plant material. It's very rare. They prefer decaying plant material, like decaying cattail leaves would be around the pond. So that's good, but it scares the inspectors to see numbers of these snails in a shipment. They can't tell them apart because they're so tiny from other species, even really trained people with snails and slugs. And so the conservative default is to refuse or delay a shipment until they feel comfortable with the situation. That's been challenging because there's been very little work on these snails to manage them as a pest. There's mostly work on the ecology. And as you can see, again, they can hide under the lip of a container or under the tag, and they're just really tiny at certain times of the year. They hang out in the gravel and the wet substrate on the soil, particularly in container nurseries. And in the fall, they can actually climb up into the trees. That's, again, another behavioral response, which makes it very hard that most folks aren't looking for snails in trees, but that's what they do. So several times a year, we have growers who have shipments that are delayed or stopped at a state or international border to deal with the problem. Places like California, we've educated them enough about these things that in general they'll let the shipments through. But it's also a problem at the customer or end buyer level, in which case if they receive a product and they're unhappy with seeing slugs or these snails in there, they'll often ask a nursery for a credit for their next time they buy. And one of our nurseries said those credits can add up to $10,000 a year for them. That those are the sort of costs that most of us aren't intuitively wouldn't think about, but they're there. Because the credibility of these nurseries, they ship material, and their end buyers want to know they're not infested with any type of pest. And then even though it won't eat the plants, these snails are considered a pest. And you can develop a reputation very quickly if you ship more than once to a particular buyer with these snails or slugs in the shipment. So that's been a real problem for them. Again, very little information on how to manage them. So I have run some trials up at the North Willamette looking at both what we call foliar applications of molluscicides and bait applications of molluscicides. We looked at both the conventional types of materials that our growers are using so that they have a feel for how well they work, and also threw in some novel products. We all want to look at softer things out there. So we've looked at limonene, which is basically distilled citrus peels. It smells like somebody's eating an orange next to you. It's very pleasant. We've looked at cinnamon. And many of these things are what we call generally recognized as safe. They're often food-oriented products, oils, or derivatives of plants. And we looked at a combination product that was kind of the botanical vapam, sort of a fuming type of material, with capsaicin, which is hot peppers. And that one had a bit of a kick. It makes you talk. So we were really excited because our very first trial, which was a simulated sort of nursery with pots with soil in them, and we put a known number of snails in there, the amber snails. We saw some good activity from a couple of these. They looked very close to the other carbamate pesticides, and we were really happy. And then we redid the trial on actual infested plant material, where there's lots of places for the snails to hide. And one of the things we now learn about these types of softer materials, many of them don't have any residual. And so if you don't get actual contact with the snail or slug, you're not going to get control. They're not going to come out and touch it later and be killed. And that's going to be a real issue because snails and slugs generally are pretty furtive. They come out at night or at other times when a lot of times we're not there. And again, things like the amber snails are often very tiny in places that are hard to contact. The other thing I wanted to mention, because although we're talking about commodities, these slugs in particular, and some snails, are really a problem in a lot of different systems, you know, in the home landscape, public parks. I did speak with, because I've worked with him in the past with this issue, with Toby Query at the City of Portland. He works with restoring a lot of the sites with native plants up there. And he's had a real problem with slugs. And he said it's actually, in some cases, the limiting factor in being able to replant and colonize the understory of a lot of these sites, that the non-native snails or and slugs, particularly slugs, are so abundant, way abundant compared to the natives, that and they preferentially prefer the native plants that we have out there, like Trillium, that he's trying to establish, that they really can't get those plants going. They also hit their seed stands when they're just trying to seed things in, and he said he's had nearly complete seed failure or seed loss to these non-native slugs, and that's about $300 per acre in the direct cost for that, not including the labor again to establish these plants. And he said that the end effect is that in many cases, because of these exotic non-native slugs, the non-native plants tend to flourish in these situations. So the impact, the ramifications are widespread from these little critters out there. So that was kind of covered most of the ground, I thought, initially, and it would take any questions. I am a little bit hearing impaired, so I mentioned that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the records, my name is Helmut Rock. I'm the director of the Plant Protection and Conservation Programs with Oregon Department of Agriculture. And thank you so much for the opportunity this morning to contribute to this informational hearing regarding the adverse impact of invasive slugs and snails to our agricultural and also natural resources here in Oregon. So how do we fit in this context here with slugs and snails? So the mission of my programs with Oregon Department of Agriculture is to protect Oregon from invasive species getting into Oregon here in the first place. That includes also insects, gypsy moth, Japanese beetle, noxious weeds, pathogens, and obviously here slugs and snails. How do we do that? We have exterior quarantines that we enforce. Robin just mentioned some of them. We also have a quarantine, and I passed out, I think, a little package for you, members of the committee, the quarantine against the exotic Phytophagous snails that we have in place. But we don't trust that people follow always the quarantine, so we have a second barrier in place. We have early detection and rapid response approach that includes surveys. You've seen thousands of insect traps out there. We try to detect early on an infestation of invasive pests here in the state. If we find them, we try to eradicate immediately, and we monitor throughout the process. So this includes, for instance, our biggest program is gypsy moth, Japanese beetle, but also noxious weed, purple star thistle, flowering rush, we mentioned that, sudden oak death, and obviously exotic slugs and snails. So in general, if we find an incipient population of exotics, we try to eradicate that if it's feasible, because this is the best way to do it. When the population is still small, it's cost productive for us. If eradication is no longer possible, in case opposite exotic snails, some other pest that we don't, brown marmot stink bug, spotted wing drosophila, where we don't have any tools anymore to keep them out or eradicate them early on, we research and we implement adequate control measures, including biocontrol, to manage these pests, to keep them below a threshold where they cause damage to our growers. And also, this helps to protect our environment, obviously water quality, watershed protection, by minimizing the overall use of pesticides if we don't do anything against invasive pests. As Robin mentioned, growers and all the public has to use pesticide to control their pests on their property. So exotic slugs and snails are very significant pests, as we heard, to our agriculture and also our natural resources here in Oregon, causing economic damage. And I wrote down some of the numbers that is very interesting for us as well. We do pest risk analysis where we estimate the potential cost of an exotic pest here in Oregon once it establishes. And we've done last year, end of last year, we've done an economic impact of our noxious weeds here in Oregon. And we come up with $80 million of damage caused by some of our noxious weed, Scotch broom, blackberry. And economists who concluded these studies, they like to correlate that to loss of jobs. This is about $80 million is about 2,000 jobs lost. So this is a situation, as we said, where we control the noxious weed. If we don't do anything about it, this can quickly multiply to $2 billion a year. That is 40, 50,000 jobs losses. So I think we're sometimes underestimating, and I'm glad to see the real-time cost here for our grass seed. So this gives us a really good idea what the problem is and how much of a damage that can cause. So Robin also mentioned already nursery products that we ship mostly out of the state can be held up at borders, national borders, also international borders. We've been involved with our counterparts from Hawaii Department of Agriculture in shipping Christmas trees to Hawaii, Mexico, and other states and countries, where, as you remember, we are the number one state for Christmas tree production in the country. Slugs were one of the biggest problems in Hawaii. We assisted our counterparts there. They came to Hawaii. They came to Oregon. We went to Hawaii. We helped them identify, and I brought one of my experts here, Josh Fleck, here from my office. He's our mollusk identifier with me. We helped them identify then, and for your in your package, I put a nice table together of exotic, mostly exotic slugs and snails, but also there are some native ones on there, just to give you an idea how they look like. That one of the problems is that this slug presence in nursery products and Christmas trees can hold up a shipment or can be rejected. That is all associated with a high cost to the shippers. And many nurseries and Christmas tree growers have invested significant amount of time and resources to exclude exotic slugs from their grounds. So in order to keep exotic slugs and snails out of Oregon, we have implemented an exterior quarantine, and I've included that in your package. That is OER 603-052-0129. The quarantine against exotic Phytophagous snails that I mentioned, that applies to stuff coming into Oregon. In addition, my programs are also involved in the following activities. We do an intensive statewide detection survey for exotic slugs and snails. We did that last year, actually. Again, we do it periodically over the years. We go to the high-risk sites where products come into the state and search what is present. We prepare these nice flyers. We work on identification guides using our high-tech digital imaging system in my lab. We have collaborative work going on with OSU here. Joel Lundgren is our Christmas tree extension specialist. We've worked with him for several years now with the goal to minimize the impact of slugs, in particular in the Christmas tree industry. We've done some research with Joel here on the slug presence. Why are slugs in the Christmas trees? How can we exclude them from the Christmas trees? And we helped also a specific grower to build a slug container washing system. This was based on the experience that we have in Hawaii, where they use a washing container to eliminate the koki frog from plants shipping from Hawaii to the mainland U.S. So we used that, and the grower took it and assembled a container that washes the Christmas trees with hot water and cleans the Christmas trees from pests that are sitting on there. And again, most of the slugs are not a pest of Christmas trees. They're just, as Robin mentioned, contaminants. We're also working with Mexico, and we were able, my state taxonomist was able to get the slugs that Mexico is concerned about and had them on their quarantine list to remove them, because we could show that these slugs are already present in Mexico, so they couldn't quarantine us for that. That helped our Christmas tree industry to facilitate the export to Mexico, the largest export to Mexico.
Director Rugg, I think Representative Gorsuch may have had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem.
I missed it. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we know that there's different kinds of plants and slugs like some more than others. Are there different types of Christmas trees that attract slugs more than others? Because there's all sorts of different types of Christmas trees.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, we have two for Hawaii. We have usually two, the duck fir and the noble fir, that we export. Okay. These are the main Christmas trees that go out. It is in our experience, and what we experience in the field, there's not really a difference or a specific attractiveness from one Christmas tree variety to the other. It's more than anything, it's a management. If you leave the Christmas trees overnight in the field, you can't get them out. Insects and slugs try to hide in these Christmas trees, and then they get carried into the container and then transported to Hawaii or Mexico or other states.
Follow up?
Yes, just to note, though, Representative Gorsuch, that the slugs with good taste are found in noble Christmas trees.
Yes, I would agree with that. Nobles are better. That's absolutely true. One other question for you. So I realize that the main thing here is that slugs are eating things, right? And do they transmit any other diseases from one plant to another?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, this was my next point here.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr.
This
Chair.
About 3 years ago when we were in Hawaii, and we had about 40% of all the containers infested with slugs. Mm-mm. Coming into Hawaii. That caused some media outcry because of the potential, and Hawaii is very concerned about the rat lungworm that can be transmitted also by slugs and snails. So they were very concerned about that, and this is one of our plan to do here in Oregon. We haven't really looked into that, but since we have a PCR, a polymerase chain reaction lab here in my office, we wanted to look at that and check out, do we have the rat lung worm here in Oregon? Mm-hmm. And we could look for that. And so this is certainly a concern. We wanted to follow up with that.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. So in addition, then, as Robin mentioned, we are conducting inspections of material leaving the state. We check containers, we check products as well, nursery stock, and obviously Christmas trees as well, for the presence of slug and snails. This is quite some work, as Robin mentioned. They are very difficult to find, and there can be different types out there that we have to look at and identify. So with this, I appreciate again that the members here of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources recognize the importance to manage invasive species such as invasive slugs and other pests, and support ODA's, OSU's, and our industry's efforts to protect Oregon's natural and agricultural resources for future generations. Thank you for the opportunity again to testify, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Mr. Members, Representative Gorsuch.
I'm sorry. I just have one other question, and it's a just a little deviation, but you brought up sudden oak death. And what is the status in terms of dealing with sudden oak death now? Do we have an adequate way of stopping it, or are we still not there?
No, we don't. Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch. So we're looking at two situations. We have sudden oak death, P. ramorum, in nursery production, and we have it in the wild, basically in forest situations. So we have a collaborative SOD working group between many agencies, including Oregon Department of Forestry, OSU, our federal counterparts, and obviously our local folks and our industry, to deal with the infestation down in Curry County. We just extended the quarantine boundaries in that county. We're still not yet on county level. We try to control it, but it's all, if we would have all the money in the world, we probably could do something about it, but it's unrealistic. Then we can stop it at this moment. So ODF is looking at going aggressively after infestations in the forest. They have a 300 to 600 foot buffer around positive tan oak. These are the main hosts for sudden oak death in this county, to eliminate the areas. That is one thing. So we have to look, because this is also sudden oak death, P. ramorum, is also a federal quarantine pest. So the feds jump in there if we wouldn't jump in there. On the other side, we have tens of thousands of samples that we take every year in nurseries to make sure that our nurseries are free of this disease, because this is also a problem for export for our nursery industry. If a nursery is positive, there are mitigation processes in place that we enforce, and we work with the nursery to make sure that none of the infested plant material can leave the nursery.
So, one quick follow-up. So, as I understand it right now, we can't really treat the plants. We probably have to eradicate the plants.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, yes, there's... We have to... What we do, in particular in the wild, we just destroy tan oak. We cut it down. We burn it. That's currently the only method to kind of stop it. Okay. Our researchers, ODF, OSU, are working on products to find if there's a way to use a fungicide to control it.
Yeah.
But the problem is also it is airborne and waterborne, so it's really difficult to eliminate that. And
I understand it can also feed on Douglas fir. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, the main host, and I'm an entomologist, I apologize,
sure,
is tan oak down there,
okay.
And I don't think duck fir is an important host at all.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Thank you.
Committee members, feeding off of Representative Gorsuch's line of questioning, thanks to Representative McEwen, Mr. Gallagher is preparing an informational hearing on sudden oak death syndrome.
That would be really good.
For our committee, Representative McEwen.
Yeah.
Well, actually, thank you, Chair Witt. I was just going to mention that you and I had a discussion about that. It's a very significant interest in the southern part of the state, as you all well know. And it has tremendous implications on exporting timber products and exporting a number of agricultural products. And so I'm delighted that Chair Witt was willing to actually raise it to the level of an informational hearing. I think Swiss needle cast and sudden oak death are really important issues that I think it would behoove us to become more familiar with as time goes on. I also thought I might mention My grandmother taught me very early on when I was young and trying to grow some plants and became a horticulture major and had a great interest in it as I went through college. I found out that if every couple of weeks I go out on my porch where I have potted plants, I take a nice bottle of beer and pour it into a pie plate, that the next morning I will have a whole pie plate full of dead snugs and slugs and snails.
Right.
And I think they've probably died a very happy death. And I think there might be a nice partnership here with our craft brew industry.
Oh,
is there something
are.
That
there
we can
is.
Do?
Very humane.
On a large agricultural scale, I'm sure it's not very adequate. But, boy, if you put it out on your deck under your flowers, it works really, really well.
I can envision Representative kind of a Maoist cultural revolution where
yes.
Oregonians, it becomes our civic duty to spread across the landscape with bottles of beer and salt shakers.
That's right.
On a nightly quest for,
for
anyways.
Slug eradication.
Is that like a slug hunt?
It's very effective.
That would be a slug fest.
Vice Chair Krieger.
This sudden oak thing's right so cold in my backyard, and I have a lot of oak on my tree farm just north of the Rogue River, and it hasn't gotten north of the Rogue as far as I know. But what currently is a private landowner required to do if it shows up on his property?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, you're putting me on the spot here. And we have a quarantine imposed currently in Curry County. And we try to work with private and public landowner if there's an infestation on their property to help them to get rid of the tan oak that is infested.
Please.
You assist in it, but do they have to do the work or pay for the work? Or 'cause on a small independent little tree farm, it could be a huge cost to eradicate it. And then, of course, you got to come back and replant underneath the forest practice rules. And so it would seem like it would be almost impossible. And I know South Coast Lumber down there has it in it, through it, and around it. So do they have to then sanitize the logs that are, that's the fir logs that come out of there? Is there a sanitation process before they can mill it and remove it from that area?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, yes, we have mitigation process in place that commercial production has to follow. If you want to take out logs out of that area, there's a quarantine in place. And I can get you all the information, or we maybe see you again in that specific SALT hearing to give you all the details. And we probably have our plant pathologist program manager with us to give you answers better than I can do right now.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for that suggestion. Additional Representative Esquivel.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, we, I believe, had a informational meeting on the
slugs.
Sudden oak death and its progression from California into Oregon. Mm. It'll be interesting to see how much that's grown in the last 6 years.
It has.
I believe we had it, Mr. Chair, 6 years ago. We had a hearing on that.
Yes.
It's been a period of time. I know.
Yeah. Interesting to see how it's progressed.
Yes. Yeah. Vice Chair Krieger.
I'm looking at number 4 on your little chart here. He looks just like the creature that has showed up on our tree farm by the tens of thousands, which were never saw them before until about 2 years ago. And they, every time you put dog food in the dog dish, you come back, and they'd be in the dog dish by the dozens eating the dust. I mean, they were everywhere. I couldn't buy enough beer to drown them all. You could fill a garbage truck full of them. It was unbelievable.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that's exactly right. So number four and number six are the main culprits for us, in particular in Christmas tree production. These are the contaminants. So that's Arion. There's a big genus there, and Deroceros is number six. These are all exotic slugs. These are not from here. They made its way through live plant trait that we have. They made it here, and they're now one of the main problems, and also here for grass seed growers and as contaminants in containers.
I kind of wonder where they came from down in our country so fast. I mean, pretty soon you might have saw one or two, and boy, the next year they were everywhere. Out in the pasture, in the fields, on the roads, all over the house.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, you can look at our trade routes and identify where most of our invasive pests come from. So we receive a lot of stuff, including myself, from Europe, Asia. That's where we get our pests from. So Arion and Deroceros are European pests.
Very interesting. Representative Gorsuch.
So the global economy really expands the ability for these rascals to be moved around.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, that's exactly right. We have, my program manager recently presented that there's a wonderful graph. You can see the lines going between the different continents in terms of trade, and that relates directly to the invasive species that we see here in the U.S. in general and in Oregon in specific.
And please, in terms of treating, so going back to the grass seed, and we know that these critters go somewhere, right, in the evening. By the time we all get up, usually they're kind of faded away. Is there any way to identify those locations and then, besides pesticide, sometimes hot water is actually something that can affect some creatures like that. Is there something like that where you could target certain areas where you think they may be hiding, or is that just not doable?
It's not doable from the standpoint that when it's one thing on a lawn because it's nice and even and you're mowing and everything like that. When you get out into a grass stand, you have large crowns, and where they like to hide is underneath those crowns, and trying to penetrate anything, including chemicals, at that particular level is very, very difficult. And so, the best time to apply anything that's going to work is when they are out and actually feeding in our particular situation. And so that would be, 4 o'clock in the morning type thing. And even from a standpoint that, believe me, we tried everything. There's growers out there that will go out, and if the stand's a little bit older, we'll roll them. You can actually get out and roll them. The problem is that as you get into an older stand, of course, that's not effective because it's so bumpy. You're missing them as you go along. So we have tried to think outside the box, and it's been proposed many times that we start drinking beer and just keep dumping it into the tank and try it from that standpoint. So it's not that, at this point I think anybody would be willing to try just about anything as we continue to see this kind of damage.
Well, I know that Vice Chair Krieger mentioned all of the influx of the number fours he has, and when I was in Indonesia I saw they would have duck herders, and they'd have massive numbers of ducks, and they, in the morning, they would herd their ducks out into the rice paddies and the fields to feed the ducks on the one hand, but also to diminish
That's true also as far as like chickens go. So you can put chickens into your garden and you're going to see a reduction in slugs. On a large scale, of course, production, that doesn't work. But
I could envision a new career path for Vice Chair Krieger as a duck herder.
Yeah. I got wild turkeys. I think they're eating them too.
Can I ask? Representative
Gorsuch.
I promise this is my last question. But earlier, we had Mr. Beyer talking about his concern that reducing fire was perhaps aiding in the resurgence of slugs. Feel about that statement, or how do you feel about that statement?
Well, again, not being a scientist, you can only go by experience. We have seen this was not a problem before when we could burn. And I mean, not to throw this out there, but the fact of the matter is burning was a very useful tool as far as an insecticide, a fungicide, and a pesticide as far as herbicides. And so since the banning of burning, I would definitely say it's very, very fair to say, and you could probably go out to any farmer in the area, but we've tripled our use of all of them, and that would include slug control. So to actually say on a scientific level that I have data to support that, I don't, but I can look at my bottom line and tell you what I used to spend on slug control and what I spend now after burning, and it's correlates, as does herbicides, as does fungicides. So...
Please. Mr. Chair and Representative Gorsuch, if I may ask, add to this. This is not answering your question, but there's a difference between, obviously, if the slug is a contaminant, like in Christmas tree fields, and in a production field like grass seed, where they directly feed on the grass. So with OSU here, John Langren, we worked out and identified the critical points where you can contaminate that and told growers, for instance, okay, in the year of harvesting, remove your weeds, because weeds are a host for the slugs. And then if you don't have weed in your field, you have less slugs in your Christmas tree field the year when you harvest. So we identified some of that. Obviously, that's a little more tricky when you have a whole host there. And
I was also going to tie that in together. It's interesting. It's very rare that you see all aspects. So I'm fighting it on a production level, and I'm using it, like, right there in the field. I'm losing it. Within the nursery industry, they're doing both. They're getting hit both in the field and then on the economic side, not being able to ship into certain states or losing it on the sales side. And then you have the Christmas tree industry that's not necessarily being damaged by the slug itself feeding, but actually on the economic side with the sales side. And so you have the entire gauntlet. And so when you start talking about potential problems, although it's the first we've really started talking about it, this is way bigger than, you know, what everybody initially thought. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm curious, too. We've talked about the invasives that Oregon has. We've talked about the threat that these pose to our indigenous industry. Have we gotten to the point where other states are beginning to become concerned with our sharing some of these pests? I know you mentioned the need to make sure that we don't ship Christmas trees or ornamentals with these pests. How concerned might the rest of the world be about the products that are traded sector products here in Oregon?
I can talk about it in layman's terms, so, and then the smart people can talk. But we ship grass seed all over the world, okay? We ship it into all of the states, all 50 states. We ship it all over the world. So if you're just talking, let's just say weeds, for example, other states are definitely on board. They're paying attention, and they're making sure that we're not shipping amongst states different weeds, invasive species. There's lists that we have to follow. So before we can ship seed from one state to another seed, we actually have to look at their noxious weed list to find out whether or not we can even cross that line. It's becoming more and more of an issue. And that is true with countries all over the world. So if I'm going to ship into Mexico, I have to literally pull up Mexico and look into see where I'm shipping seed. Now, that's not the case in slugs, but it would be the same premise that, you know, when you're going into certain countries, you have to be aware of what they may or may not detect and what you can and cannot ship.
And so is it possible, Macy, to put a price tag on that?
No, because every state would be different.
Yeah.
So what is a noxious weed in North Carolina that would keep me out of that state may not be a noxious weed in South Carolina where I can ship it to.
But an additional cost that we may not have even begun to account for.
Absolutely. So, and when you start talking on a worldwide level, it gets insane when you start talking about shipping of Christmas trees and or nursery stock anywhere. I mean, and other commodities.
And Mr. Chair, I want to just guarantee you, you have excellent people working at the Department of Agriculture.
We do. Thank you.
Trying to take care of that issue. And we have a Western region. We work together with our neighbors, California, Washington. And we work on national level and also with our federal government to avoid exactly what you mentioned, that we spread our wealth of invasives across our state lines. So that's why we have a very good program here, insect program, noxious weed program, to make sure that we do the best we can to avoid spreading our invasives and also to protect our industry here. Mm-hmm. And to facilitate that we can ship without any problems across the country and also overseas.
Well, thank you for that very important work. Thank you very, very much for your presentation and your patience with all our many questions. It was a great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Next, I'd like to call up, some researchers from OSU, Suhaya Rao and Patrick Iverson. Good morning to both of you. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to share the slug situation in Oregon. My name is Sujaya Rao. I am an entomologist professor. In my research, I look at pests in field crops and also native bees, especially bumblebees in agricultural crops and in native landscapes. But today I'm here in my capacity as the entomology leader at Oregon State and also as associate department head of crop and soil science, which is the department that has taken the lead in addressing this issue in the absence of an entomology program at Oregon State. So I'm going to start the presentation and then I'll pass it on to my colleague, Pat Iverson. He'll give you a molecular biology 101 lesson. And then I have also with me Amy Dreeves and George Hoffman and Robin Rosetta. They're the ones who really worked on the slugs, and so they will answer your questions.
Thank you.
So a year ago or so, the Soil and Water Conservation District wrote letters to the president and the dean at Oregon State University expressing concern about the slug situation and wondering what's going to happen, because we had a researcher, Glenn Fisher, extension entomologist, who was also addressing slugs. And so they want to know what was going to be the university's response. And so when I heard about the letters that were written in December, I volunteered to address the issue, try to get a sense of what the situation is. And so in March, we organized a slug summit that Macy talked about earlier, and the idea was to bring together pretty much various groups that are affected by slugs. And it really was interesting. One of the outcomes of this was just what they mentioned earlier, is that the grassy growers didn't know that the Christmas trees were affected. And it's like, how would Christmas trees be affected? And really, so it was really nice for everybody to sort of be aware of not just the impact on their own commodity, but across all commodities. And the bottom line, of course, was that, okay, this is a huge problem affecting a wide area of different cropping systems. And on the one hand, we're really proud that, you know, Oregon, we are so diverse in our cropping systems. And so that's great. On the other hand, now we have a situation where we have a whole group of agencies and commodities that are affected. So what are the crops affected? Well, these are just a range, examples of some of them. And so just to give you an idea of how different they can be. For instance, in the case of wheat, which I see I haven't even listed, it's the seeds that are affected. In other cases, it's the foliage that's affected. In Christmas trees, it's a quarantine issue. And then pastures. I'm working with a rancher where we're trying to see how we can include enhance the clovers in pastures so that they would benefit in terms of the protein for the feed, but also native pollinators. And so, you know, we gave him the seed, he put it out in fall, and then everything was gone. The slugs got to them. And so now we don't have many flowers that are going to be present for us to even evaluate the impact of the native pollinators. So pastures, too, because they are raising some of these on their pastures, is going to be a problem. But bottom line is that pretty much any new seedling, what are the slugs looking for? Something soft, something they can eat. So they're really not choosy. And like I mentioned before, we're all looking for diversity of diet, and the slugs have gotten to it way ahead of all of us because Oregon, we're providing it for them. Additional impacts. So one thing that hasn't come up a lot today is the hindrance to adoption of soil conservation. We're interested when you plow a field, then you have erosion issues. Now, plowing is actually a good pest management tactic. And so earlier in this week when I was talking cultural control strategies to my students on campus, this is what I mentioned, because when you plow a field, anything that's underground is going to get exposed, it's going to dry out, birds get to it a lot easier. And unfortunately, you know, there's a negative to it, but it was something that perhaps was benefiting. So now when you go towards no-till and minimum tillage, what happens then is the slugs, you know, are undisturbed to some extent. And I've been on an annual ryegrass field where, you know, a truck just slid across because it was just so slimy with all that slime laid down by the slugs. And then, you know, as was mentioned earlier, the home gardens, and nobody likes a plant like that in their garden. And for years, I've been trying to promote entomophagy as an entomologist, get people to eat insects. I haven't had much luck there. I've had even less luck in people trying to eat slugs. Escargot people will eat, but why not slugs? I'm a vegetarian, so I don't need escargot, but people say no. They draw the line at slugs. So you all have the sheet, which shows a great picture of all the slugs in Oregon. I've just listed some of them here just to give you an idea. But here's a field. This is a red clover field. It's actually a plot on campus that I went to look for slugs. And so, you know, you can take a guess as to how many slugs that there are in just the small area. So there's at least 15 that I was able to look at in this picture. And so, you know, there are these aggregates of them. And here you can see a field where, you know, the crop is just not there, and because slugs have pretty much wiped it out. So what is the issue? So it's a problem that's been here over decades. It's almost as long as people can remember there have been slugs. Why then is it suddenly become a big issue now? Well, there's several new pest species. You get more, you know, as you get globalization, you get new things coming. You got new pests that are, at least we're observing that they're causing the damage. And there's these issues, you know, as changing practices. We've had the phase out of burning, which when you burn it, you don't have all the straw left on the field. The straw is a good environment for a lot of pests, including slugs, and even things like improving drainage. So while we go towards bettering some things, comes the downside. And then, like I mentioned before, as we go towards no-till, no plowing, or minimum tillage, this problem is getting exacerbated. So slugs are present everywhere. I get this question, why is such a big problem in Oregon? So earlier in the year, I was in D.C. For a leadership meeting, and I took a couple days to go meet with the folks, the national program leaders at the USDA in the NIFA building, because they get proposals from all over the country, and I thought maybe they can give me some ideas in terms of what can we do about the slugs? Are there any new ideas, the new things people are trying? And that's the question they asked. We all have slugs in our garden. Why? And I told them, look out the window. You guys have snow. We have nice warm weather. And so the slugs are not going to be doing anything in your neck of the wood. But back home, they're just chomping away at all our new seedlings. And so that is one of the reasons we have a much bigger problem. So the cold winters help the other parts of the country, whereas for us, we have almost optimum conditions. All that rain, which is great for our cropping systems, help with all the plant growth. Unfortunately, that rain also reduces the efficacy of some of our strategies. So what are we doing? Well, until and until there's legislation so that we could put beer out there in the field, what people are using are slug baits. And there is many compounds, Robin mentioned many of them, there are various compounds, many companies that are selling this. And it's one of the problems, of course, they have to be used a lot. And it's interesting. So as different commodities look for new markets, I've heard a lot of times, you know, India and China are looked at because you've got 1 billion people. So if you want to sell almonds, boy, you know, there's a big market. Sadly, the companies that are selling these, which are based in Europe, are looking towards Oregon for their market because we provide them huge fields where they can be used. So what are the problems with these baits? The active ingredient is effective, but there's many challenges. So I'm just going to list some of these examples. They're more attractive to the adults and the juvenile. And if you look at the life cycle of a slug, and only part of the time it's an adult, it's got this fairly long several months when it's a juvenile. And at that time, this is not really working. They're not attracted to a distance. I think Robin mentioned it. So you really have to put it close. It's a bait. So you have the poison and you have something to attract it. And if it's not going to be attracted from a distance, and slugs are sluggish, so, you know, you've got to have a lot of material out there so you make sure that they actually get to them. And then it's observations have been made that one slug that manages to survive that poison sort of learns to avoid the bait. And so then, you know, the same thing is not going to work for it. And this is an interesting situation, which apparently is not there in Europe. Earthworms are also attracted to the bait. Remember, there's the active ingredient and the bait. They're attracted to the bait, and so they take the bait and take it into their burrows. Fortunately, the earthworms are not killed by the poison, but they take it away. And so before the slugs get to them, the earthworms have taken them away. And then you lose them because of the rain. So also there's temperature effects, and so at certain temperatures, they don't work as well as other temperatures. And so what do the bait companies say? Well, you've got to use them at higher rates. Sure, they'll get better market. But the bottom line is, so growers are spending the money, the labor, buying the product, putting it out, and we still are at the situation today. What are people doing elsewhere? So I've talked to researchers elsewhere in Pennsylvania. They're looking at cover crops, not really an option for us. We are the ones producing the seed for their cover crops there. They're using the oils Robin mentioned in California. Europe, which has the slug problem like we do, they have nematodes that are effective. These have been discovered in California. We haven't found them in Oregon yet. But they're expensive, and maybe they could have potential some high cash value crop, but perhaps not for some of our field crops. There's predatory beetles in Europe. We have them too here, but some of the problems is that these predatory beetles are taken out when we try to manage some of our other insects. Because the beetles are insects, so you use an insecticide along with the pest, there go the predatory beetles. So what we're thinking is, you know, we should try and see how we can convert a challenge to an opportunity. If these markets are looking towards us as the place for them to sell their product, how about we create a center for slug and snail research here? We've got diversity of slugs. We've got plenty of slugs to do any experiment. You get hundreds within minutes we can collect them. So what happened in the past is we had multiple people working on them. We had Glenn Fisher, who's at Oregon State. He's the person I mentioned earlier who retired. He worked on slugs, and he was our extension entomologist. Bill Gavin at USDA, who was working on slugs. And then Amy Dreves, George Hoffman, and Robin, who are in the room. They have the experience with slugs, but because of budget situations, they're now working on other things. They're working on the spotted-winged Drosophila, which is also a big problem for us. They're working on pollination, which is also a problem for us. And so that's one of the reasons, too, is that at the moment, we really don't have the resources to get some slug research done. So what are our needs? Well, what they told me in DC, and what the growers are also saying is we need to start thinking outside the box. What we need are short-term strategies and long-term strategies, and we're going to need some funding. We're passing the hat around to get money both for the research and for the researchers. And so as a result of that slug summit in March, a lot of interest was there on looking at sort of molecular techniques. And so before I go into that, just to give you an idea of what kind of short-term techniques we can be looking at. Well, first of all, as Robin mentioned, you know, we don't even have good data on some of this information. We need to compile it. What's out there in terms of other countries? What are they doing? What's effective? What is adoptable here? What are the economic impacts, commodities, what are the impacts of the soil conditions, water in different parts of the field. You saw a picture earlier where there was a problem in some places and not the other. And then maybe we can try and look at the enhancing the bait. Maybe this company need to start doing something, or an entrepreneur, where let's try to find something that's attractive to slugs but not to earthworms. And I was told by ODA that, interestingly, while the active ingredient is regulated, the bait part may not be. So you could have extracts of plant that are acting as baits to attract the slugs. Companies could use different materials, and that itself could have an impact, why it works better sometimes and why it doesn't work sometimes. And so, and then looking at all these control options. So these are just some examples of some of the things that we could look to in terms of the short term. Long term, again, we're trying to see molecular, are there any options out there? And there's some exciting things that are happening as you've had advances in molecular biology. And so given the interest from the stakeholders, I organized another slug RNAi meeting where we brought in an expert from Florida who has worked on RNAi, who's worked on RNAi in honeybees and also in other pests. And so we wanted his input and that of others in terms of what is the potential for slug management. And so since I'm not a molecular biologist, I'm going to hand over now to my colleague to talk about the molecular option.
Excuse me. My name is, or I guess I should say, chairman and manager of the committee. My name is Patrick Iverson. I'm a professor in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State University. I have an appointment in the Biochemistry and Biophysics Department, but I'm also a part-time employee at Sarepta Therapeutics. You may know of this company as AVI Biopharma. I was the Senior Vice President of Research and Development at AVI for 18 years. This is a technology that was developed at Oregon State University as a spin-out company. It created a company called Gene Tools, which sells the molecules we work with. An interesting note is that as of this week, Sarepta is submitting a new drug application to the FDA for the treatment of Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a drug that I developed starting about 11 years ago, and now it's being in the approval process.
Congratulations.
And thank you. I also have drugs in late-stage development under contracts with the Department of Defense for Ebola virus, for Marburg virus. I have a compound being tested by the National Institutes of Health for influenza A, and several approaches to antibacterials for multi-drug-resistant bacteria. But as a person who seeks innovation, as Sarepta matured, I felt that my skills would be better in bringing some of the skills from commercial to the academic industry and from the pharmaceutical industry to the agricultural side. So that's sort of the background. The molecular biology is always challenging to know exactly how detailed one can present this sort of information. Suffice it to say that when we refer to siRNA or RNAi, has many names, but it's the same thing. They represent a small interfering RNA. So in the scheme of molecular biology, we know that we have a genome made of DNA. Copies of that genome are made. They're called RNA, and they produce the proteins for the most part, although in the last 5 years, we've discovered a huge new information about RNA. We used to think only 1.4% of the genome would make RNA. Now we know that almost all of it does. And so we call it the dark matter of the molecular biologist. We did find, and oddly enough, this is a discovery that was made at Oregon State University, that double-stranded RNA, two strands, unusual in that aspect, could enter a cell or is actually endogenously produced by cells. This is how plants, for example, petunias, the petals of their flowers have many colors. It's because this phenomenon occurs naturally. So they produce a double-stranded RNA. This is broken apart, fits into this complex we call RISC. RISC then finds the RNA molecule that is a target, much in the way your word processor would search for a word. So it would seek out a specific sequence of letters, it would bind to that sequence and only that sequence, and then that complex would cut the RNA, thus disabling it. So this is a pretty straightforward process and a natural one, but how would we go about using it? In the pharmaceutical industry, there are a number of companies that are currently developing RNAi or siRNA, including Techmira, Alnylam, Centaurus, which was recently purchased by Roche, iTech. Actually, there was a company called siRNA that was purchased by Merck for $1 billion. Alnylam has a market cap of about $11 billion, so this is not a small industry. So the advantages of why would we use RNA approaches to this type of problem? Well, first of all, as when I was a student, I sequenced, for example, the first human enzyme for drug metabolism. It took me a year to sequence about 17,000 bases of the human genome. We now do this overnight. In fact, we do the entire genome in a day, which is 3 billion bases. We now had a dream that we could achieve the entire human genome sequence for $1,000. That's been achieved and is a routine fact now. So the ability to take an organism that we don't know too much about and sequence its genome, sequence the entire transcriptome, which is all of the RNA, are measures that we can do in an afternoon at a fairly modest cost. What is important then is compiling that information and using the information. But that information is the basis of these technologies. And in this case, we seek out, or if you were thinking of it from a word processor, if you could make a word that is 14 letters long, it will only find one word in the genome. That is to say, it only has one occurrence. So when we make our sequences for RNAi, if we make them longer than that, their specificity is outstanding. There are no other targets. There are no other off-target effects. And so that, if, for example, if you killed a snail with such a technology and it were sufficiently stable, even if a bird came along and ate it, that sequence wouldn't be able to affect the bird. The other is that, and that's really the point of the second point there, is I just sort of thought, if you look at the currency we deal with, there are only four letters, A, U, G, and C. And so it makes discovery of such a drug rather simple, actually. And I had done a number of exercises for the Department of Defense, which were called rapid response exercises. For example, our Ebola drug was the product of an accident that occurred at USAMRIID. I developed a drug in a matter of hours, and this drug now is in its late stage development. That process used to take 4 to 6 years and used to cost several dozens of millions of dollars. We can do it in a matter of hours.
Wow.
So instead of searching Amazing. For which is the right oil or the small molecule, which takes much, much time developing on an assay, which you don't really know how, it has to be specific for that organism, this technology is actually very broad, very easy to implement. Just to sort of point out, this is a slide that I borrowed from the USDA representative who came to us at our, we called it the Slugfest for RNAi, about a month ago that Sujaya organized. But it really speaks to the fact that we believe that the agricultural world is embracing this technology. And so they're bringing it to a number of different applications. It has a large financial impact. And as Bruce Sujaya mentioned, this has been a company called B-Logix was using this technology to try to deal with the colony collapse syndrome of bees. And Monsanto now has purchased that company, and they will continue with that. But some of the problems when you use a small molecule, as we would call them, like the metaldehydes and some of the molecules that are currently sold, or the carbamates that were mentioned earlier by Robin, is that they have a broader spectrum. That is to say that they kill things you didn't intend them to kill. It takes quite a long time for them to be developed, and resistance is almost inevitable. That's part of biology. And then, of course, the emergence of secondary pests as a result of losing that sort of collection of events. So what would be better would be something that is more target-specific, again, the RNAi approach, I guess I can speak to Ebola, where we ask the question, can that virus become resistant to our drug, for example? And we use the modern technology, and we sequence the entire virus 100,000 times. And we did that for every monkey that we treated at multiple time points. And we found that there were no emerging resistant viruses. So it's the technology itself addresses the emergence of resistance. And then we don't think this would affect the collateral species. So it should be a very safe technology.
That's amazing.
This sort of gets back to what do we need to do? What is the process of doing this? So I tried to make a schematic blueprint of a slug. So the blueprint, if you think about it from a construction point of view, is the genome. This is the DNA sequence of the slug. That genome is made into RNA, and I put a picture of a contractor there because essentially what the RNA is for addressing how to manufacture the instructions that were encoded in the blueprint. And that ultimately the product is the slug. But if we were to use RNAi to block the contractor's capability, we would prevent the production of the slug. We could prevent pretty much anything. We could prevent the ability of the slug to make its own sort of mucousy, sticky stuff. We could certainly make it lose its color. We could go after any gene, but we do know of some genes that when we block their expression, the slug would die. So the steps are we would need to get the genome sequence. And as it turns out, I think the University of California, their mascot is the slug.
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz. They actually had a network or internet crowdfunding scheme to generate $20,000 to sequence the genome of the slug. So that actually occurred back in December of this previous year, and that will be available as a public material, which means we can save a little money there. But what we really need to do is to sequence the transcriptome, or what genes are actually being worked on by the contractor. And we can do that at Oregon State University pretty simply and generate those specific target sequences that would be essential for designing the RNAi drug. Once we've done that, we could test those compounds in simple systems, and once we're confident that they're effective, we could implore them for the full slug. But for distribution and manufacturing, since I've been through this process with Sarepta, it might be possible, and certainly it's possible, to move the gene that we would use to create the RNAi into a yeast. And as we've learned in some of our meetings, that the reason the slugs sit in the Christmas trees is because they find them on the moss that grows on the tree. But they don't eat the moss. They eat the yeast that's sitting on the moss. And that yeast is exactly the same family of yeast that's in beer. So it's possible that if we were to move this gene into that yeast, then the slugs would eat that yeast, and that would be the delivery of their control measure. So that should be relatively inexpensive to manufacture, and it should be something that could be done fairly broadly. But of course, that would be an organism that would now be called a genetically modified organism. So we do have a question mark as to how acceptable that would be. But at any rate, through a regulatory process, we could deliver that yeast to crops. This is done, actually, in Israel to control West Nile virus, so it's not as crazy an idea as you might imagine.
Can I ask
the alternate approach?
When you just mentioned that last item, so it's the mosquito over there that they're trying, and they were neutralizing them by taking care of one of those genes to make them.
Right.
So,
but they were actually, they were targeting the virus. The mosquito has the virus in its belly, and so they, at early stages of the mosquito, they could actually, apparently, they eat yeast. And so they spread the yeast on the places where the mosquitoes grow up.
Yes.
And apparently it controls. I mean, I haven't seen any data from this, but I did read about this. So it meant that it wasn't an insane idea to try to.
I saw two articles on it, too.
Yeah. So the alternate approach, and might take a bit more time, would be the one that would be somewhat analogous to what we did at Sarepta. Just sort of a simple distinction is that the RNAi is a natural material, but it is extremely unstable. So in an alkaline condition, in sort of at 100 degrees at, for 10 or 20 minutes, the material will be degraded. And so but in a yeast, it would live inside the yeast, so that's not necessarily a problem of duration. But that fundamental question mark of an unstable molecule may be one of the limitations. So the alternate approach would be to use the chemistry that we do use at Sarepta, and that's in the lower right corner. That chemistry is extremely stable. We actually created compounds that we could irradiate to sterilize stents that we put into hearts. You can autoclave it, you know, sterilize it at high pressure and high temperature, and the molecule is not degraded. We've actually done several hundred patients where we've administered these compounds, and they come out in the urine completely unchanged. So there's no enzyme that will degrade these molecules. So the idea might be to alternately just, once we have a good gene, use the stable approach. And it could be that maybe we want to consider both approaches, as I think Helmut pointed out. You know, the emerging question is a different question than in the trees. And so it could be that a stable molecule has its application in one place and a less stable molecule has its application in a different place. And so I just tried to give some thoughts about comparing technology. The PMO is the technology of Sarepta. The RNAi is the unstable molecule and small molecules. And so what is exciting is we could develop a target compound very quickly.
Yeah.
And then we would have a bit of work to show how it works and how to implement for commercial use for growers. But there are some regulatory questions, such as if we created a genetically modified organism, there's a interest in sort of having this label of organic product. Mm-hmm. And there are many intermediate options here. If we didn't put it in a yeast and we just spread the RNA around and that was sufficient, then that wouldn't be a genetically modified organism, and it would be something we could apply fairly quickly. But if we wanted a more stable compound, we could use the morpholino compounds, but they would be higher cost to manufacture. So there are sort of balancing issues. And my belief is that, you know, most of these things, you don't really know what you face. You just sort of have to plunge ahead and then modify as you need to. So I'll leave it to you, Sujata.
So this is sort of just a concluding piece. So OSU has made a budget request, and that includes funding for a new faculty member to work on slug and insect pests, both the research and the outreach. And so that person, we hope we get the position. If we get the position, then that person will sort of use a multi-pronged approach along with partners. We don't see this as a one agency solving the problem situation. And so we've already brought people together through the SLUG Summit and all our discussions. And so everybody's going to work together in terms of trying to solve the problem. Not actually solve it, trying to solve the problem. And we've already started discussions. So folks at ARS, they've got some scientists with RNA background. Patrick has some background. NRCS is putting in some money. And so we're trying to pass the hat around, see what opportunities there are to address those short-term and the long-term sort of approaches. And Patrick mentioned about the genetically engineered organism. When Monsanto is using RNAi, that's what they're trying to go after. But that's a lot of money when you're trying to register something like that. It also won't work well here, in my opinion, because we have multiple commodities. So what we're going to need is maybe something that can be applied, like a foliar spray, across different commodities. So that would affect the slugs no matter what the landscape. With that, I would like to thank you all for your time and the opportunity to share this information. And my colleagues and I will be happy to answer questions. Like I mentioned, we have Amy Dreeves and George Hoffman, who have worked extensively with slugs, along with Robin Rosetta. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. What a fascinating presentation. Mm-hmm. Representative Frederick.
Thank you. I miss the bench when you start talking that way. Okay, just want you to know. Especially since my favorite organism was, in fact, yeast. So it was, and I was working with mitochondria in yeast and had a good time with it. But I had to leave the bench, so there was no way for me to keep up with all the stuff that you're talking about. When we would try to put together something, it was going to take several weeks just to get the sequence on just a small portion. So I remember those days. It is extraordinary. I am also, though, concerned that, you mentioned it, and so I'd like to have some more conversation at some point about the broader impact. If we were to put this this yeast, for instance, into the environment, who else is going to take it up? What else is going to take it up? What kind of impact might it have outside of just, obviously you're saying that there's only a certain sequence in terms of human, but it could have an impact on other organisms. And if that's the case, what? And how do we follow that particular chain of interaction? That's one significant concern of mine. And then how we begin, you were a couple of things back, the approach, what was it? It was the approach in terms of getting the other compounds, the other slug delivery issues. It would be interesting to hear about that. So I'm curious about that. I remain interested and concerned about how that might work.
Yes.
So thank you.
Yeah, Representative Frederick, the first question having to do with what happens when an off-targeted organism might internalize that compound. I'm currently reviewing that subject because when we file documents with the FDA from a commercial side, for the pharmaceutical side, we do ask questions about off-targeted effects within the host. So you know, if we want to target in a muscle, we don't really want to see something happen in the liver or the kidney. So those questions have been addressed in a great deal of detail, and we don't really see. In fact, compared to the small molecule approach, this is a much safer approach. The best data that I have been able to find is that Monsanto is filing for registration of their SmartStack 6 is a product that they're filing for registration with, I guess, the USDA, that will be in the next sort of 4 to 6 weeks. And so I've decided to review the information they have on the toxicities that occur. So they target a corn rootworm, and they looked at all of the neighboring species to see the specificity. They actually gave it to them in concentrations that were, you know, 1,000 times to a million times higher than what would kill the cornworm, and they have no effect. So this is an extraordinarily specific strategy. The other question is one that I am also asking, because what we don't know is if, for example, the environment were to modify these molecules, would they represent some gain of function? And I don't know that we have all the answers yet, but so far there really is no indication from the application side, the sort of practical side, that is an issue.
Thank you. That's the kind of thing, and we don't have much time. I would appreciate that. I just would caution you, within certain communities and within certain political aspects, it's not necessarily the scientific ones, although I think there's still some concerns. Monsanto has its own issues. And I would suggest that I would not necessarily use them as the
reference,
the best example of corporate involvement, because they do have their own issues, indeed. Thank you.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. So we saw the $16 million budget request. Where is that right now? Is that with is it in a particular budget bill, or where is it?
Do we know? Representative Korsky, I really don't know. All I know is part of the request that was made to the legislature in terms of funding for the university.
Okay. Oh. perhaps Mr. Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer again. That $60 million request, that is the request for the OSU statewides. That bill is now sitting in the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and we hope to have it moving.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that question. Panel members, what an extraordinary presentation.
Exactly.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for your presentation. And please feel free to call on us. We've asked you for your expertise here today, and sometimes we're able to accomplish some things in this building. And should you ever feel that we might be able to be helpful, please don't hesitate to call on us. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.
Yeah, I think it's time to slide.
Thank you all very, very much.
Yeah, I think it's time to slide.
We stand adjourned.